change. One of these days.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program looking at the jobs, incomes, debts, the economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Been a professor of economics all of my adult life, and I teach now at the New School University in New York City. A little later, we'll tell you about the websites and other ways to communicate with us that can enhance the benefits that this program seeks to provide. Let's get right into it with the short updates for today. I wanted to mention that there's a kind of drama being played out, particularly in Europe, but in other parts of the world as well, that deserves, once again, our attention. This has to do with the struggles, particularly dramatic these days, between Greece on the one hand and the rest of Europe on the other, led particularly by the German government of Angela Merkel. And it has to do, really, with how you run an economic system like capitalism. That is the name of our system. That's the way we organize in most of this world the production of goods and services. And what I mean is a relatively tiny number of people who are either called government officials or boards of directors or chair of the board or CEO or those kinds of names, they make all the decisions, what to produce, where to produce, how to produce, and what to do with the profits. The vast majority of people come to work, whether it be in an enterprise in Shanghai or an enterprise in Cincinnati or in Bristol, England or in Lille, France or wherever it is. The mass of people come to work, do their job, use their brains and muscles, typically 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and then they go home. What happens to the fruits of their labor is somebody else's business. What happens to the profits their labor helps to produce, somebody else decides. They live with the results of those other people's decisions, but they are excluded from them. They do not participate in any direct way. Okay, that's our capitalist system. And in 2008, it crashed big time. It produced global unemployment, which we count around the world in the hundreds of millions to this day. It has produced devastating economic consequences that have been concentrated in some parts of the world where the suffering is really grim. Greece is one of those parts, but Ireland and Portugal and Spain and Italy and parts of the United States and Mexico, and I could go on, have also suffered very grievously. How was this crash handled? Step one, governments everywhere were appealed to by the biggest corporations in the country, by the banks and insurance companies above all else, who rushed to the government that they had been so critical of, begging and pleading to be bailed out of the crisis their capitalist system has brought on everyone. And governments everywhere, being very attuned to the biggest businesses and the financial ones in particular, governments everywhere were comfortably complying. Governments everywhere poured out the money. We call those bailouts. Their monetary authorities and central banks provided loans and guarantees. Their executive branches of government provided spending, loans, bailing out companies by buying shares of stock. Every conceivable way was found and utilized to save the corporations. And in the process, governments borrowed huge amounts of money to bail out the banks and the insurance companies. The irony was they borrowed the money from those banks and turned it around and lent it back to the banks. And why does this craziness make sense in the topsy-turvy world of capitalism? Because the system had broken down and the companies didn't trust each other anymore. No bank was willing to lend to another bank because they couldn't be sure that that bank would be able to repay because the whole system was shaking. And so the government came in as the kind of neutral player. The banks would lend to the government because they didn't trust anybody else. That's right. The banks didn't trust each other, so they lent to the government on condition that the government would turn around and either lend it or give it to them back. They even got it so nicely worked out that the money they gave to the government would pay them interest for, and then the government would lend it back at less than it paid them to borrow it in the first place. They even made money off the bailouts. But here comes the really tough part. Once the bailouts were done, the big banks, now that they were working again, now that the government had saved them, were concerned about all the money that they had lent to the government, and they wanted to make sure the government would pay it all back. So they demanded that the government pull aside the money, set it aside to reassure the banks that they would get paid back all that they had lent to the government. If it sounds crazy, it is. But here comes the worst parts. The governments cooperated. The government said, oh yes, we have borrowed a lot. The deficit, our borrowings, that's the problem. So we're really sorry, but we're going to have to lay off large numbers of workers. And we're going to have to cut back on social programs so that the money we used to spend hiring workers and that we used to spend to have those workers provide social services to our people, all that will stop and we'll use the money instead to pay back the bankers who lent us the money that we used to bail the bankers out. Yes, it's crazy. And if it sounds crazy, it's because we have an economic system that works in this crazy way. But here's the real nub of it. We are all suffering from the unemployment as governments laid off workers. We're suffering from the unemployment as people who are laid off can't buy goods and services, so people in the private sector lose their job. We're suffering because the social services we need more in an economic crisis are being cut back, so we have less government help when we need it most. Does that sound like a crazy system? Yes, it does. And that's because it is a crazy system. Greece has said in its election of their new Syriza government, we want out of this crazy system. We're a little poor country in a corner of Europe. No one in their right mind could blame us for causing the economic crisis. You know, for years before that, the Greek government borrowed money. And money was lent to the Greek government by the French banks and the German banks and the British banks and the American banks with the blessings of their government. And why? Because they thought Greece was a good borrower. They decided, as banks do, that that was a good place to lend money. So they did. What brought that to an end? The economic crisis that washed over Greece like it did over the whole world, but couldn't possibly be blamed on Greece. So what are you doing now? You're saying to the Greeks, well, you see, we don't want to lend you anymore. We don't like that you're such a deeply indebted country. We're having a crisis in our own country. We don't want to help you anymore. We don't want to lend to you anymore. We just want you to pay back and to make your people suffer. But we tell you this wonderful story, and this has been the story of Europe since 2010. If we lay off public employees, if we cut off government spending, then the government can use that money to pay down its debts, to keep its lenders happy. And that's the smart, right thing to do. And that will get us through these hard times. And that will make the situation better. And the Greeks waited. They waited from 2010 to 2011. And then to 2012, and then to 2013, and then to 2014, and here we are in 2015, and after all these years of the suffering they went through, and their economic situation didn't get better, just like it isn't getting better in Italy, or it isn't getting better in Spain, or it isn't getting better in Ireland, the borrowers are paying off the lenders are happy, but the mass of people are not. The minority is taken care of. The one at the top that brought us the crisis. But the mass of people pay the price. Austerity was and is a way to take the burden, the pain, and the costs of a breakdown in capitalism and make them the problem of the mass of people. It's as critics have said for years, capitalism is a system that socializes the costs and privatizes the benefits. The profits and the gains go to the few. The costs and the pain, well, those are democratically spread around. The Syriza government says no. But the real issue that the Syriza government victory that Sunday in January, the reason that's so important is that it brings all of Europe, and indeed all of the world that is imposing austerity on the mass of people, it forces the world to confront, is it an acceptable economic system that brings periodic crises like this? After all, the crash in 2008 is the second major collapse of capitalism in the last 75 years. The last one was in the 1930s, the last horrible one. Between the end of the crisis of the 1930s and the beginning of the one we're in now, that happened in 2007 and 8, there were 11 other economic downturns in the Western world. Wow! What an unstable system. It is not just that it brings us crises, periodically doozies like the one we're in now. It's also just as important. It's a system that bails out the top, the very ones who brought the crisis by their speculations, by their derivatives, by all the games that they played on us as a people. We bail them out first, and then we tell everybody else, austerity for you, bailouts for us. When the bailouts came in 2008 and 9, did the Congress worry in the United States about how much money they were paying out? No. They were told it was a crisis and it had to be done. So they did it. By the trillions in the Federal Reserve and in Europe. By the billions, government after government. Hundreds of billions. In the United States' case, a trillion again. Deficits of a trillion a year in 2011 and 12. No hesitation there. Now it's austerity for everybody. You know, you have to be foolish to find this reasonable or persuasive. Let me turn to responding to questions that we often do at this part of the program that you have sent in. And the questions this week are really remarkable and interesting, and they center on an alternative to capitalism as an economic system that we talk about on this program. So let me begin by reminding everyone what that alternative is, and then we will talk about it. The alternative to capitalism is a system in which the organization of production, what goes on when we produce goods and services, is radically different. That is, different how? Instead of a handful of people, a board of directors, usually 12 to 15 people in most corporations, instead of them, that group of people, making all the key decisions, what the enterprise will produce, how it will go about producing it, you know, the technology that will be used, where the production will take place, here or next door or the next community or in a country overseas. And finally, it's the board of directors, that group of 12 or 15 folks, who decide what to do with the profits. The vast majority of people, the ones who do the work of the business, who work in the factory or the office or the store, they don't make those decisions. They come to work and do what they're told. 9 to 5, 5 out of 7 days of the week, they use their brains and their muscles, and they make whatever the goods and services are that this company, this corporation, produces and sells. But all the decisions, they are excluded from. Those are made by the 12 to 15 people who are on the board of directors. And how do the 12 to 15 people on the board of directors get those jobs? How are they there? The answer is the shareholders elect them. That's right. You get one vote per share. If you own 10 shares, you get 10 votes. If you own 1 million shares, you get 1 million votes. And if you own no shares, that's how many votes you get. None. Since most people working in most corporations have no shares of those companies, neither they nor the general public, who have no shares, have any say. And since we know that 10% of the people own 90% of the shares in companies, we also know that a tiny number of people are in the position to have the votes to decide who's on the board of directors. That's kind of how it works. It is a tiny minority that runs our businesses. That's how capitalism works. Not the fancy story in the textbook, not what is told to children in high school about companies. That's the reality. Okay, that's how capitalist enterprises are organized. What's the alternative? Well, the alternative has been for a long time and is now becoming more and more interesting to people. The alternative is, has various names. One name is producer co-op. Another name, worker co-op. Here's the name I prefer. Worker self-directed enterprise. I like that awkward phrase because it says exactly what I want to underscore. An alternative way of business is if the workers themselves say, we don't want shareholders to pick who tells us what to do, who runs the enterprise. We know it better. We understand it better. We depend on this enterprise, and we want to be in charge. We want to direct our enterprise ourselves. And that's why I call these workers' self-directed enterprises. In these enterprises, the workers are themselves their own board of directors. Let me say that again. The workers are their own bosses. Think of it this way, just as an example. Monday to Thursday, you come to work, you do whatever the job is you've always done. Friday, you come to work, you don't do your usual job. You sit around all day in meetings to discuss what the company should be producing, if it's different from what you're already doing, how to produce, what technology, what methods to use, where to produce, whether to have it here or to move to China or whatever. And finally, and most importantly, you sit around and decide how to use the profits that all of you together helped this enterprise to generate. Workers' self-directed enterprises. And before I talk to you about the problems you've asked me to address concerning these enterprises, one last point. This kind of enterprise is very old. It has existed for hundreds and thousands of years. Human beings have been interested in this a long time. What's interesting now is that the failures of capitalism, the crisis we're going through, the gross inequality we're living through, etc., are making more and more people say, we must find alternatives. And folks are rediscovering and becoming very interested in the alternative of worker co-ops, worker self-directed enterprises. So now let me turn to the particular questions you've directed to me. Many of you are wondering, how in the world would such an enterprise get going? Where would it get the money, for example, to start a business? Let's assume a group of workers want to do this, and they certainly exist all over the world. How might they do it? Well, I'm going to just give you a list, because we don't have to guess how it might be. I'm just describing to you how, in fact, functioning worker self-directed enterprises have indeed done this over and over again. Financing, big problem. Sometimes workers use their own savings. That is, they get together and they say, we'll pool our savings and set up an enterprise. That's happened. Sometimes trade unions, who have funds of various kinds, say that they're going to use their funds, or part of them, to get these kinds of enterprises going, because in the long run, they want workers to have an option to being an employee of another company to become their own bosses. Churches can finance these sorts of things, especially when they start small. Sometimes customers, consumers, can get together and come up with the money, sort of like starting a business that they will benefit from, and that they become, in a sense, the provisioners of financing. Perhaps more typically, some of these co-ops can go to banks. And if not commercial banks, if they won't do it, maybe they can find their way to credit unions and institutions that are already aware of the desire of working people to run their own economic lives. And finally, and very important, the government. It is perfectly reasonable and possible to go to the government and say, there ought to be alternative ways of producing in our society so that people have a choice, freedom of choice, whether they want to buy a product from a top-down hierarchical capitalist enterprise or they'd rather buy from a cooperative, democratic, worker self-directed enterprise. There also ought to be freedom of choice for people looking for jobs. Do you want to work in a top-down hierarchical capitalist enterprise with a board of directors and all of that? Or would you rather be part of a collective of self-directing workers? If we want people to have freedom of choice, something we say in the United States all the time, then the government has an obligation to finance the creation of these kinds of enterprises. And as a model of how to do that, we have Italy, which passed in 1985 the famous Marcora Law, by which the government provided to unemployed people subsidies and financing to set up co-ops. One of the reasons why Italy has so many more co-ops than other countries. Other big question that we have time for is, well, what do you do in a worker co-op if some people are more skilled than others? Don't you have to pay them more? And won't that disrupt the collectivity of the co-op? And the answer is no, it won't. You know, a co-op is a collection of people. And a co-op quickly understands, and this has happened many times, that different people have different skills. The trick is not to say this one is more skilled and this one is less skilled. The trick is to understand that a person who has more skill in this area will be different from a person who has more skill in another area. Maybe one person is to work at a machine because he's really good at that, and another person is to work in the office because they're better at that. And another person, his job is to develop the morale of everybody working together by providing interesting activities or educational programs. In other words, there's a place for people's different skills and aptitudes and passions. It's a little bit like not being so rigid that you only have one measure. For a company to succeed, it needs lots of different things. And lots of different people can be skilled in lots of different areas. The trick is to do that well. And you know something? Even capitalist corporations have long ago understood that to be sensitive to people's different skills may often pay off. A co-op will do that as a matter of course, and it will find how to position different people. Finally, co-ops would allow us to think seriously in a way we haven't before about what is the appropriate size of a corporation. You know, in capitalism, you get bigger and bigger, and every company wants to get bigger, and every company wants to eat up its competitors and to become the big fish in the pond, to monopolize. But we all know that when you get huge companies, they can corrupt our politics, they can make it very unfair how the business world is organized. Ask any honest small business person in this country how it is to compete with the big ones. Maybe we as a society ought to be able, and co-ops would make that much easier, to decide that we don't want enterprises to get larger than a certain size. We don't want that for the same reason we don't want to have a tiny number of very rich people and a mass of poor people. If co-ops distributed the profits they earned, you think they'd give it to a few rich people, would get a lot, and everybody else would have nothing? Never happened. A co-op, the workers together would decide, some more, some less, but they distribute it out. And they might decide to keep all co-ops beyond a certain size from growing further, because we don't want that kind of society. Capitalism has never figured out how to solve that problem. Co-ops could. These are some of the ways in which an alternative is something we ought to have, we ought to see everywhere around us, we ought to have the capacity to look at it and compare it to other ways, capitalist ways of doing business. Because if the co-op is a better way, then, friends, the slogan, we can do better than capitalism, is proven. And we will have had the chance to evaluate that there's a better way of organizing our economic life. Great questions you're sending in, and it's really a joy to be able to answer them in a systematic way. The worker self-directed enterprise is an idea and a concept whose time has come. Not only because capitalism is delivering the bads instead of the goods to most of us, but also because there's a long history of worker co-ops in the United States, in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, and Latin America. We have a lot to learn of the existing experience. Many of them have been very successful. Let's learn from that. Let's give real choice to the people in our societies. They deserve it. We've come to the end of the first half of this program. I invite you to stay with us as we transition over to the second half of this program. And stay with us. We will be right back.
Prosecuting DA, Cassandra's paragraphs. My modus operandi is carpe diem, whether de facto or de jure. Comprende, the people versus. You ain't a sensei, the teaching that style of wordplay. Week of the Wednesday, regardless of what your friends say. They're all disabled, stricken from the record, and deemed inadmissible. While this long arm with the
Come back, friends, to Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. And in this second half of the program, we're going to talk about a major topic for the day, which has to do with the so-called free enterprise system. That is, earlier in the program, we talked about workers' self-directed enterprises, which is an alternative to the free capitalist enterprise that we're going to be discussing now. And this is a critique. It is the other side of seeing the importance of going in the direction of worker self-directed enterprises. The other side of that is to be clear about the limits, the criticisms of a free enterprise system. So let's first begin by what is seemingly meant by the phrase free enterprise. what's in the minds of people who talk about that is a modern capitalist corporation, large or small. And then there are important differences between a small family enterprise with two or three employees on the one hand and a huge monster corporation with tens of thousands of employees. I don't in any way mean to suggest that they're identical. But they do share this notion of quote-unquote free enterprise. And what does that mean? Well, it means, for example, that the enterprise sets its own prices. It decides, the people who run the enterprise, what the price is of whatever it is they're going to sell. Now, of course, they're not free to set any price at all. If they set a price much higher than what their competitors are setting, they won't be able to stay in business very long. But nonetheless, within the limits that they face, they set prices. And the same applies to wages. They are the people who decide what the wages ought to be. Even if the employer is three people, or two people, or one person, and the employees are 50 or 100 or 1,000, the wages of the many are determined by the decisions of the few. That's how, in practice, free enterprise works. What else does the free enterprise system do? Well, it chooses the technology. In our capitalist system, the board of directors or the owner, operator of an enterprise decides what machinery, if any, will be used, how the workplace will be laid out, who will be doing what where in the office or the store or the factory. In other words, everything having to do with the organization of production is decided by a handful of people at the top or their designees, like a foreman or a supervisor. And it's done for the mass of people who do what they are told and do not participate, by and large, in determining what that technology is. And then again, most importantly, in a free enterprise system, it is the owner-operator or the board of directors in a corporation who decide what to do with the profits. Will we use them to expand and grow the company? Will we change the technology? Will we go into the production of another kind of commodity? Will we hire more people? An endless array of decisions that are very important in the lives of the workers they already have, in the lives of the workers they may add, crucial decisions for many people made by a tiny number of either boards of directors or owner-operators of enterprise. Now, the freedom of those who own and operate enterprises in a free enterprise capitalist system goes together with the unfreedom of others. Now, that's always true. It's a little awkward for people to face, but in general, the freedom of some is the constricted freedom of others. I wish it weren't so. I wish we always could have more freedom for you, and it would mean more freedom for me, too, or at least no less, but it often doesn't work out that way. So let me give you some examples from the history of the free enterprise system. Over the lifetime here in the United States of the free enterprise capitalist system, we have had a constant struggle, which we call the antitrust problem. What does that mean? The tendency of free enterprises to compete with one another, for those who win the competition to destroy and absorb the workers, the machines, and indeed whole companies that they have defeated in competition through mergers and acquisitions and so on. Companies strive to get larger, more share of the market, more employees, more dominant position in their industry. And when they get to be dominant in their industry, guess what? They jack up the prices. They make even more profits. I mean, this story is repeated throughout the history of the free enterprise system. And masses of people, and including many companies, become aggrieved that the very big, powerful monster companies are ripping them off with high prices, with their power to shape political decisions, write the laws, influence through the mass media how their very activities are seen. And so there have been powerful movements in all capitalist free enterprise economies to have the government come in and break up the trusts, antitrust, make laws against big monopolizing businesses. We have the Sherman Act at the end of the 19th century. We have the Clayton Act in the beginning of the 20th century. And we have the antitrust division of the federal government. And every country has that because the freedom of enterprises to compete and to become bigger and bigger has produced, here we go now, unwanted effects in the community. The market system, the free enterprise market system, has produced unwanted results. And so we have movements to limit them. Guess what? No sooner do the movements to limit them get some bite and limit them a little bit, well, they discover ways to get around that problem. And so we have an endless struggle in which the companies, the free enterprises, outwit, outmaneuver the antitrust laws and regulations and do their work and impose the losses and unfreedoms on the rest of us who have to pay the high prices because we're not free to do otherwise because they have monopoly control. Think about certain computer companies, think about certain telephone companies, think about certain utilities and so on. And then the government tries to catch up. And we're always in this cat and mouse game where we lose. Here's another example. Free enterprises are very creative in coming up with ways of paying working people very little money and having enough working people in the society desperate enough that they have to accept work at low wages. That has been such a terrible result for capitalist economies, creating vast masses of desperately poor people who impose the poverty on their children as innocents who can't escape from this poverty, that every major society in the world has produced a minimum wage, a law that forbids the private enterprise system from continuing to do what it showed a commitment to do throughout its history, which is to create desperately poor workers. And then there's every effort to get around it. The one I've always liked here in the United States is the federal minimum wage that doesn't get raised with the cost of living. So the real benefit and protection it provides weakens as prices go up. I've also found it amazing that we live in a society which says if you're a worker in a hospitality industry, a restaurant, for example, you don't qualify for the minimum wage. You are legally allowed to be paid much, much less because it is said you get tips and that therefore the tips need to be somehow credited till the employer can pay you even less, making you dependent on these tips, etc., etc. These are endless, like with antitrust, struggles of the free enterprise system to be free to do something that makes the children and the suffering workers at low wages unfree to live the American dream, unfree even to live a decent life in a decent neighborhood with decent opportunities for their children. Here's another example of the free enterprise system's problems. Safety and health. The workplace is a notoriously dangerous place. If and when employers in the free enterprise system thought they could get new workers to replace workers who got sick or injured on the job, they could, and they did, save money on using unsafe machines, allowing conditions, air, water, to be unsafe in the workplace. It became such a scandal in country after country that laws had to be passed. That's right, health and safety laws. We have the Occupational Health and Safety Administration in the United States, and they're constantly having to fight with enterprises who are violating the minimum standards. So they have to, same cat and mouse game as with antitrust. And we're constantly suffering the consequences in our lives of a free enterprise system that does that. Last example, and I could go on. The free enterprise is free to take the profits it earns and instead of investing them to build up the economy, to provide jobs, the free enterprise is free to hold on to that money and not invest it. Current estimates are that American corporations have in their hands $2 trillion that they're not investing. You know why? Because they don't think it's economically profitable to them to do so. And because they are free enterprises, they are free not to invest that money. That means millions of Americans, for example, are free to be unemployed because the only way they could get a job is if those enterprises invested that money. And it's not as though we don't have important things for people to do. The environmental conditions in the United States are a disaster. Our central cities need to be rebuilt. The provision of childcare in our society is a scandal. It is so poor and so rare. The way we treat our older folks. We have lots of important things to do. There's the money to provide the jobs to get this done. But because we have free enterprises, that money is allowed by them to be withheld from what the community needs. The free enterprise system has enormous social costs. And whatever its virtues, we are not being honest to anybody, and above all, not honest to ourselves as a people, if we do not face that and recognize it and deal with it. Well, then, the argument might be said, we might hear it. Well, yes, but over the long haul, the free enterprise capitalist system has delivered the goods. Well, there's an element of truth to that. Capitalism has been a system that has increased output in our world and has raised the standard of living in most places over what it once was in the systems that preceded capitalism. But you know, that was true for the feudalism before us, relative to what went before that, and indeed for the slave economies in some cases compared to what went before that. That's not enough of an argument. You're better than things were before doesn't answer the question, could we do better now than you are doing as our dominant system? When you confront the free enterprise capitalist system with that question, the results are not so clear. Does the capitalist system deliver the goods these days, say in the last 6 or 7 years since the free enterprise system crashed in 2008? The answer is pretty clear. If this is a system that delivers the goods, it's delivering it to the top 10% of the people. Everybody else is having a harder and harder time. This is the first generation in American history of young people who, in order to get a college degree, have, on average, to come out of that process with a bachelor's degree and tens of thousands of dollars of debt hanging over them. Is this a system delivering the goods? No, this is a system making it harder and harder to get a decent job, making it harder and harder for young people to start a life, burdening them with debt, burdening them with job problems, burdening them with inadequate income. For the mass of people, the free enterprise system isn't delivering the goods. Even if it did that in the past, it isn't doing it now. And that's a serious problem if you're honest in estimating whether a system is or isn't the best you can do. Then there's the question, doesn't the free enterprise system really grow the economy quickly? Even if you admit that maybe a disproportionate amount of what is produced goes to a small minority of the richest people, even if you admit it, it is a system that grows quickly. It's a rapidly growing system. Well, here I think the evidence is, again, not so fast. Perhaps is the thing that I ought to say. In all honesty. What do I mean? Well, let's see. The two major economies in the last 100 years that the folks who love free enterprise denounce as sort of the opposite of free enterprise are the Soviet Union, existing from 1917 to 1989, and the People's Republic of China, existing from 1949 right through the present. Those economies didn't allow free capitalist enterprise. They basically substituted either government enterprise, not the free private enterprise, the government enterprise, or they substituted, as in China today, a kind of mixed economy in which you have government enterprises alongside of private enterprises, but the private enterprises are heavily controlled by government policies in a variety of ways. So that the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China are the examples of non-free enterprise. So now let's see economic growth. Well, let's start with right now. There isn't a Soviet Union, so I can only compare the free enterprise system of the United States and its economic growth and the free enterprise system in Europe and its economic growth on the one hand with the People's Republic of China's rate of economic growth on the other. In the last quarter of 2014, the economic growth rate in the United States was 2.6%. In the last quarter of 2014, the economic growth of much of Europe was zero, or very close to it. Some countries were shrinking. They were in negative territory. By contrast, the economic growth of the People's Republic of China in 2014 is estimated at about 7.5%. That's right. The rate of growth of the Chinese economy, a non-free enterprise economy, is many multiples of what it is in Western Europe and North America. On the theory that economic growth is a quality that's important to assess in comparing free enterprise, free capitalist enterprise, and alternatives, not looking so good for free enterprise, is it? And the economic growth of Russia was similarly rapid. Let's look at these two countries, Russia and China. And this is not an argument for anyone to endorse Russia or China or prefer Russia or China. This is simply an argument which system grew faster, the one that limits government control, limits government enterprise, or the ones that emphasize government enterprise and emphasize government control. Free enterprise in the first case, not so free enterprise in the second. Which one grows faster? That's the only question we're asking and the only variable we're looking at this moment. And the answer is unambiguous. Both Russia and China were very, very poor backward, outstandingly poor backward countries when they gave up the so-called free enterprise system. Russia in 1917, China in 1949. And they moved to a system with government enterprise and government control of whatever private enterprises were left as their alternative approach. Their alternative was not worker self-directed enterprise. They didn't do that. Their alternative was government-directed and government-controlled enterprise. Both of those countries went from poor, backward nations to global superpowers. The Soviet Union did it between 1917 and 1975, despite a revolution, a civil war, having lost World War I and having been devastated in World War II. Despite all those setbacks, their rate of growth was so great that by 1975, they were the number two superpower after the United States. They had grown faster in a shorter time than the United States had, but the United States had had a much longer time to develop. And so the United States was number one, but the Soviet Union went from way back in the pack to number two. In China, it's even more impressive. It's literally the last 25 years, 30 years, that the Chinese have racked up the fastest economic growth of any country in the world. This was an extremely poor, underdeveloped, and backward economy in 1949. For them to now be the second economy after the United States speaks volumes about how far they have come, how quickly, in how short a period of time, to be the kind of mega power. They're still much poorer than the United States. There's no way in 25 or 30 years you can catch up to the United States that has had 300 to become what it is. But if you want to compare economic growth between quote-unquote free and non-free enterprise, take a look at these countries and you will see that the story and the comparison doesn't work so well for the free enterprise system. Let's move on. The free enterprise system produces what people want. I've heard that all my life. My colleagues in the university, many of them, believe and teach that. Well, let's take a closer look. The capitalist free enterprise system, we are told, produces what people want. In the sense that, look at all the consumer goods on the shelves of our stores. Isn't it wonderful how free enterprise has produced this cornucopia of objects for us to spend our money on? Well, I don't want to repeat what I have said in this and previous programs, so let me be very brief. Advertising has long made a bit of a joke of this claim. What free enterprises have learned how to do is to manipulate and shape what people want. They're not playing the passive role that economics theory and apology for capitalism and free enterprise like to portray as their role. They're not passively waiting to see what people want and then responding by producing. They are also out there spending billions of dollars to shape particularly children, when they're impressionable, as to what it is they ought to have for lunch, and what it is they ought to wear, and what it is they ought to play with, and what it is they ought to visit, etc., etc., shaping the demand. It's really at least true to say that in a free enterprise system, companies produce what people want, but they also produce the wants in those people. And that raises serious questions about the outcome, which we've talked about before. But I want to take this in a different direction. We are now experiencing inequalities of wealth and income in the United States and also elsewhere in the world that are extreme, that we haven't seen for 50 to 100 years. We have seen everywhere the discussion, the end of the middle class, the end of the American dream. Well, folks, it's the free enterprise economic system that is delivering vast wealth into the hands of the few. If you look at the people who are in the richest 10%, the overwhelming majority of them are people who either own or work in the top reaches of free enterprises. It's not your highly paid athlete or actress or something like that. It's your businessman and woman, whether it's small, medium, or corporate. Those are the people who are at the top of our economic system. That's why names like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or all of the rest, that's why they're there. It's business that catapults you into those classes. So we have to thank, if that's the word, the free enterprise system for delivering us something I would guess most Americans don't want at all, which is extreme inequality and the atrophy of what middle class there was. Finally, this is a society, particularly here in the United States, which likes to say it wants there to be checks and balances. That is, no part of the society should have so much power that other parts are subordinated to it. We should have checks and balances. That was the idea, we're told, behind having the Supreme Court on the one side, the executive branch of the president on the other, and then the congressional or legislative branch. That the three branches of government, judicial, legislative, executive, balance and check each other. Well, in the realm of economics, in our free enterprise system, you might think that we have the enterprises, then we have the unions, that would be the organization of workers, and then we have the government that can kind of play a role of checks and balances. The problem is, in modern capitalist economies, the free enterprises have basically either destroyed the unions, that's the United States, or subordinated them, that's Europe and elsewhere, to an extraordinary degree, so they're not an equal counterbalance. And they have bought the governments by all the mechanisms epitomized by the Koch brothers' announcement of $1 billion that they're spending in 2016 to shape the elections. So who are we kidding? We don't have the checks and balances. The free enterprise system has eviscerated the two other conceivable checks and balances, so we have a free enterprise system run amok, trying to convince us that it's the best thing since white bread, when everything I've just gone through are clearly present, documented examples of falling short and making us wonder why we accept uncritically an institution that screams for criticism. Thank you for being with us today. I want to remind you that we have two websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info, that provide much more of the kind of analysis you hear and see on this program. We urge you to visit those websites, to use them to communicate with us, to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, to share what you hear here with others on your own social media. I want to thank truthout.org, that independent source of news and analysis that I ask you to look at and learn with as I do from them. And I look forward to being with you again next week. Change.